Welcome to the Statistically Insignificant Podcast, episode 18, where we discuss the carbon tax in Canada. To start us off, the carbon tax in Canada. This is one of the signature Liberal Party policies since 2015. It's been in for a while, continuously incrementing by, we'll get into the details later because I don't remember them off the top of my head, and shape through the invisible hand of Adam Smith, Canadians' buying habits in order to mitigate climate change and the pollution and the climate effects that we're seeing from CO2 mainly. I don't actually know how much is applied to methane, but we may get into that later.
Yeah, there are some other policies. I don't believe methane has a price specifically. There are some non-price policies for industry right. level, I believe.
I think the main issue and the biggest reason that we're talking about this is a lot of the mounting evidence for climate change around the globe. All countries kind of need to do their part, but it is, at the end of the day, kind of a moral argument for why does Canada need to do its part when if no other country in the world does their part, we'll still have climate change. I guess at the end of the day, it's like a moral thing to do. If you know that it's wrong, do you continue to do the wrong thing? But in any case, we are at this point now. This has become a huge talking point where, surprisingly, fighting climate change in the polls is one of the only issues that the Liberals are still ahead of the Conservatives on. But that's not really enough for them to not be at least 15 points down on an aggregate of polls behind the Conservative opposition, led by Mr. Pierre Poilievre, with his incredibly successful Axe the Tax campaign right now. And so this is one of his main driving points that seems to really rile up his supporters and seems to be driving the Liberal Party out of government. So why are we having this podcast today? We're having this podcast today because we want to get to the bottom of what is the carbon tax, establish what's some of the economic theory behind why it should work, establish and pontificate even about why is it so politically fraught right now, and what do we even think is the future of the carbon tax going forward? Eric, why don't you take us away?
Thanks for that overview, Jared. And I'll just add one comment before I talk about what I think some important technical issues about why taxes work and how this has been distorted or misrepresented in a lot of talking points and dialogue. But it is generally the case that while people think the Liberal Party will do better on fighting climate change, people's revealed preferences have shown that when they believe that it costs them money, they don't want to do it. I think that's a fair and cynically accurate assessment of the average voting populace. Now, the irony might be that the populace is actually incorrect in their assessment, that the policy actually might make them better off, although we can talk about that later. But regardless, it's the case that when you poll people, they say that this policy does not benefit them and that they also are against it, but that they also want the government to fight climate change. So we're in this somewhat impossible situation, but let's talk a bit about, if we go back in time, there was this thing called the Eco-Fiscal Commission. A bunch of economists got together and created a sort of like a policy framework for how Canada could basically implement policies to fight climate change. Most economists, when they analyze this, say that the best approach whenever you're trying to reduce something that's bad, in this case, the bad thing is carbon emissions, is to let the market, which Jared alluded to, this the invisible hand, do most of the heavy lifting. And the way you do that is by changing prices, okay? And the way governments can change prices is through taxes. So I want to just enumerate some key core economic concepts about taxes and how the carbon tax is related to them. Now, I could substitute out the carbon tax for any other tax that we have in the economy, and the principles would apply, specifically for taxes where you're thinking also about things that you want to reduce because they're bad, but a lot of them are true for all taxes. That's just a specific element, which applies to some taxes. And let's just try to think through them here. So the first is, and we won't spend much time on this, but you know, why do governments levy taxes? Well, the first and obvious answer is they want to raise revenue. So they need to raise revenue in order to cover the cost of the goods and services they purchase in addition to whatever debt they borrow and possibly revenue they earn from state-owned enterprises, but we don't really have that in Canada. So that's a rounding error. And the other thing governments do with taxes is they change prices, right? So within the economy, when you levy a tax on only some goods or services, you can subsidize a good or a service by removing the tax selectively. Okay. You can reward your political constituents by, say, reducing taxes on the things that your political constituents tend to have, or you can punish your enemies. So you can tax the things that your enemies tend to buy or produce, right? So you might want to impose a tariff on a foreign producer because foreign producers don't have any political purchase within your economy within your democratic system, for example. But we're not really here to talk about the political economy of taxes. I'm just saying from a government perspective, you have these sort of interesting levers you can pull to change prices and have political effects. But from an economist perspective, these same levers also have important economic effects. And I want to go through some of the main ones and how each of them relate to the carbon tax. First, again, the carbon tax, and we can get into the details a little bit later, but there's sort of two planks. There's a part that targets industry, there's a part that targets consumers. Most people think about the part that basically taxes the gas you fill up your car with, the natural gas you heat your home with, or your heating oil if you use a different sort of energy system, as well as a coal and a few other things. So basically the really in carbon intensive products that you use. And like any product that you buy, whether it's gasoline or groceries, when economists think about how you respond to price changes, they have this idea called an elasticity, which basically means when prices go up, you buy less of something. Now, how much less you buy will vary. And so the economists say there are varying elasticities for different goods. So some things that are really, really important in your life, at least in the short term, you may not change your demand by that much, but things that are more substitutable, you might move away from. Okay. And that's a technical question. But what cannot be denied is that carbon intensive goods have a downward sloping demand curve. So you will buy less gasoline. Okay. I remember when gasoline was approaching $2 a liter, it made us think a lot more about, well, do we really want to drive 200 kilometers for a trip or do we want to take a train? And we wouldn't have thought that if gasoline was $1 a liter, because there's all sorts of ways on the margin you can reduce your demand. Or take the case of, well, no one's going to freeze to death, so of course we're going to use natural gas to heat our homes. Yes, that's correct. But what level do you set on the thermostat? Do you set it to 20.5, 19.5, 18.5? All of those are questions that empirically determine how responsive your demand is to price, but not whether it's responsive. So no one can say in any conceivable world that an economy would not have a response to a change in price on carbon-intensive goods. So if every other good stays the same in price, but only gasoline, natural gas, home heating oil go up, you will buy less of those. There's no world in which that doesn't happen.
I did just want to jump in for a second just about the downward sloping demand curve, but I wanted to just ask a bit of clarification. Like, I mean, what does that mean? I think you kind of extrapolated it. It's all about how much less of a good are you going to buy depending on how much the price was up. Is that kind of correct? And could you just extrapolate
Yeah,
a bit on that
for
or
sure.
expand
Yeah.
on that?
So intuitively, it's as you say, what's the relationship between price and demand? On a slightly more technical level, economists, they draw these graphs and they'll have price on one axis and quantity on the other axis. And like basically, there'll be a negative relationship between the two of them. And so you can think as an individual consumer, you have your own demand curve. So again, think of the thermostat example. Think of like the thermostat on the y-axis and price on the x-axis. As the price of your natural gas goes up, you're putting the thermostat to a different level, right? How fast you turn down that knob is going to vary by how rich you are and other factors and right where you live, kind of thing. But everyone is going to have some relationship where you slowly start to turn down the dial as your natural gas bill goes up and up and up. And then what you can do is you can sum that over all the households or average that over all the households in an economy. So if we're thinking about total natural gas demand, it's going to be basically, in some way, an aggregation of all of our individual decisions about where to set the thermostat. So that's like the easiest way to think about what it means for a demand curve to slope downwards. Now, the other thing, too, which I alluded to in this next idea is the change in relative prices. And by that, I just mean that when some prices change faster than others, you're going to move away from the prices that are rising more quickly. Okay. This is, again, is pretty intuitive. But you can begin to see how this makes sense with a carbon tax. So the carbon tax effectively makes anything that uses carbon-intensive energy more expensive, which means that, of course, all things will increase in price by some amount because energy is used to power and produce almost everything. The energy is an input in almost every good and service in our economy. But, and here's the key point, which is that the extent to which carbon intensive energy as an input varies. If the carbon tax goes up by 20%, then your gas might go up by 20%, okay? The gasoline you fill up your car with. But your Netflix subscription might go up by 0.01% because the domestic price of gasoline has almost no relationship to how much Netflix can sell your subscription cost for, okay? And then food is going to be somewhere in the middle because some cost of the food is all of the cost of heating and transportation and logistics, but not all of it, right? And so you imagine there's a gradient of goods within your economy, some that have almost no carbon intensive energy and some that are almost all carbon intensive energy. And the ones that are the more carbon intensive they become, the more expensive they become because of this tax. And so, all things being equal, you're going to shift away. If gasoline becomes more expensive, we say, hey, we're not going to take that trip. Instead, we're going to buy a better Netflix subscription so we can watch more shows at home, right? Because we're not taking that trip. Or, hey, you know what? Actually, we're going to take the train because Via Rail hasn't changed their prices, but the cost of filling up my gas tank has doubled, something like that. So, this cannot be debated. This will always be the case, especially once you aggregate across households. You will see people move away from carbon intensive goods towards less carbon intensive goods if carbon intensive goods are taxed. So the carbon tax has to work, at least in this domestic sense. Domestically produced goods, you will move away from those that are more carbon intensive if you tax them more and more. This other issue is that you hear this a lot, especially in dialogue around the PBO report, which is that taxes shrink the size of the economy. And this is true. This is this idea of deadweight loss. So, for example, this is an important to understand, which is if you have something that you have a 0% tax rate on, and you want to estimate the effect of taxing it by 10%, so how much revenue you're going to get, it's not going to be 10% of the amount before you impose the tax, because some amount of that is going to be lost to taxes, right? So, if people spent $1 billion on gasoline, you add a 10% tax, they're not going to spend $1 billion on gasoline anymore. Maybe they'll spend 900 million. And so that 10% becomes 90 million rather than 100 million. Okay. Simple math, whatever. It's going to vary depending on the good. And so it's true that taxes shrink the overall size of the economy, but what matters is what you do with those taxes. So, yes, if you just burn the tax dollars, then you've lost out. You've created a wedge and you'll never get that money back. But the question is, what do you do with that tax dollars to offset the loss of economic activity? And that is an open question that you can't know a priori. It depends on how you're spending the money. Let's be clear that you can't only just look at the cost of a tax. You have to look at how the tax is used to buy new goods and services when thinking about whether it's good or bad for the economy as a whole. Two more things. So one is how to think about tax fairness, and then this idea of taxing things that are bad. So let's just talk about tax fairness. So any policy, whether it's a tax, a subsidy, a handout of goods or services, is considered fair if it's progressive. And something being progressive means that at the higher your income is relative to someone, whether you pay a smaller or larger share of that. So in the case of the carbon tax, let's say that this carbon tax costs you an extra $1,000 a year. Well, if your income is $10,000, then that's 10% of your income. But if someone's income is $100,000 and the carbon tax costs them $2,000 a year, yes, they're paying more tax, but they're paying a much smaller share of their income towards that tax. And so that's a regressive tax. So it's also going to be the case that the carbon tax is regressive just simply because poor households tend to spend more money on gasoline and things that are high energy, basically consumer goods that require more energy. But again, that's only one side of the story, because there's also this thing called the rebate that the carbon tax provides, and the rebate is progressive. So the tax is regressive, the rebate is progressive. Or another way of thinking about that is you have to look at where the tax money goes. Is it used to offset the regressiveness of the tax? And we can talk about that later. The answer is yes, it is. And then finally, when you have goods or services that create negative externalities, okay, so things that are bad for the world or your country as a whole. One thing economists noted a long time ago, more than 100 years ago, was that you can actually use taxes to bring an economy into something called like a socially optimal equilibrium. In other words, without a tax, you produce too much of a good. So the classic case is, let's say you're producing something like steel, but back in the old days, the steel plants just dumped all the toxic waste into the rivers. So, yes, people got cheap steel, but then a bunch of other people had to deal with health problems, fisheries that died, etc. And the people who bought the steel, no one bared the cost of all the negative externalities of basically dumping toxic waste into the river. Okay, so the price of steel was too low.
Yeah. No one producing the steel bore the cost, because we know that the communities that lived and depended on that river bore the cost, but they had no control over producing the steel.
They had no control over producing the steel. So the consumers of the steel and the producers of the steel were able to, in effect, offload costs onto other communities.
Externally.
Externally. That's why it's a negative externality. And so economists said, actually, you know, one way to produce the right amount of steel is to tax it at the rate that it would, in effect, capture the costs on those communities you're impacting. How do you do that with the carbon tax? It's very technical and complicated. But it cannot be denied that carbon produces a negative externality, at least at a sufficient, when it's enough people are producing carbon. And a tax, also known as a Pigouvian tax, can help to produce the right amount of carbon. As in, we're producing too much of carbon globally. So if we were to globally tax carbon, we could bring it down to the right level. So that's the theory here. All of this is completely sound. Applying a tax on carbon-intensive goods would both reduce the demand, could potentially be progressive if the money was redistributed in a way that offset the regressiveness of the tax, okay? So it could be fair in principle, and that it could align global carbon emissions with what's socially optimal, as in what won't destroy the planet after enough years of heating. So all of that is completely sound, and a lot of that has been lost in the dialogue. Final thing we should then talk about is the rebate, which has also, again, caused a ton of confusion. So the rebate is the thing that determines whether or not the, in some sense, financial or fiscal impacts of the carbon tax are progressive or regressive. All that other stuff doesn't matter. Okay, so you don't need the rebate to reduce your carbon consumption. That's going to happen. You don't need the rebate to have carbon be priced properly. Okay, you don't need the rebate to do any of that. The only thing the rebate does is help to compensate individuals we think shouldn't disproportionately bear the cost of the tax. So it's completely a fairness thing. It has nothing to do with the environmental concerns about carbon emissions. Okay, so that's just a fact. Now, the way the rebate can potentially be progressive to offset the regressiveness of the tax, because again, poor people disproportionately spend more of their money on gasoline, on heating, et cetera, is because everybody gets back the same amount. It's not exactly true. It varies by province. And then within provinces, there are rural versus like urban amounts. But generally speaking, most people get the same amount. Jared and I, we're both households. We get the same amount back. So because that's the case, if you pay less than the average, you win, because you get back the average rebate, but you paid less than the average. And if you paid more than the average, you lose. Even though poor households have a larger share of their income going towards gasoline, it's not the case that they spend less on gasoline. Richer households also drive cars. They probably have more cars. They probably take more trips on planes, which are very carbon intensive. But it's just that the share of their income is smaller. And so this is where the magic comes in, which is because as your income goes up, you consume more carbon products, but at a slower rate. It means that a wealthier household will, on average, tend to have more carbon consumption than a poor household. And so that on average, a wealthy household will lose out and a poor household will gain. Now, this isn't always going to be true. Sometimes you hear this is wrong, that, you know, only the top 20% of households pay for the tax. That is completely wrong. It's arithmetically impossible. All you need to do is imagine some rich tech bro sitting in a one bedroom condo in downtown Toronto who never leaves the city. They don't own a car. They have to be winning in this arrangement. There's always going to be exceptions within any income group. You have to think about on average. On average, the more money you make, the more cars you own, the more plane trips you take, the larger your house is, the more you spend on heating, the more willing you are to crank up the thermostat because you don't care whether or not your gas bill is $300 or $1,000 because you're so rich anyway. So that's the theory there. It's been misrepresented. Yes, some people in the bottom will lose out. Some people in the top will win. But you cannot deny that the more money you make, the more things you buy, including carbon-intensive products like cars, gasoline, and natural gas. And so it's reasonable to expect, I don't think it's 8 out of 10 households, but it's going to be some majority, 50, 60, maybe 70% of households will be better off because consumption increases with income. And if you consume more than the average, you lose out.
I just wanted to interject because I do have the numbers from the March 30th, 2023 PBO report about the fiscal costs, the net costs, sorry, of the fiscal federal fuel charge. So from that, we can see that actually in most provinces, it actually is a negative cost up to the fifth quintile. But that is kind of a misnomer because it isn't taking into account other costs that are economic activity costs, which is like lost profits and employment. Yeah, what is it? Ontario, it's a negative 586 cost for the first quintile, minus $425 for the second, minus 193 for the third, minus 91 for the fourth, but then it's a $258 cost for the fifth. So yeah. It actually is kind of weird. It's only Nova Scotia where only the second quintile, so the bottom 40%, are actually fiscally in the black.
Well, so, I mean, I'd say two things. So, like one, you know, I've heard about the study and it's just one study. So like, you know, like you could probably, there's probably a million assumptions that go into it, but I don't think it's wrong, like directionally, but just keep in mind that saying that the top 20% pays for the carbon tax is true in the sense of that if you look at all the money going in versus all the money going out from the top 20%, that's the case. But there are going to be households within the top 20% that are winners.
Yeah. I agree.
Similarly, they're.
All of this is treating the top 20% as a single household, but that's not the case, right? Because really, it's just that there's a higher propensity of large carbon emitters to be in that top 20%.
But it would be a majority, because if the average is positive for 0 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80, then something probably above 50% of each of those groups would have a positive win, right? Just by reasonable expectation. Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe just one example, like imagine income tax was distributed equally between folks. That is to say that the government, we have the current income tax system we have today. And then at the end of the year, they add up all the amount of money they've raised from income tax and they give back everyone the same amount. Okay. It should be painfully obvious that higher income earners lose out because they pay a disproportionate share of the tax, but everyone gets back the same amount. So the people that worked 0 hours that year get the same amount as the people who made $500,000. Same principle here. It's going to be progressive when you redistribute money back by a fixed amount. Has to be. Even if the tax itself is regressive. Okay. I think that covers the main misconception. So for example, I've heard this idea, well, if you give the money back, then it has no impact. Wrong. It changes relative prices, right? So everyone gets back the same amount of money, but some goods are more expensive than others. So again, you buy the nicer Netflix subscription and you don't drive 200 kilometers. You stay at home. You turn down the thermostat, but you buy some nicer cheeses or whatever, right? That's just going to be how it works, okay? So it doesn't matter that they give you the money back. It's because the relative prices changed. And it cannot be the case that poorer households lose out on average because poorer households consume less because they have less money. That's just how the economy works.
And I think that actually has been backed up with some empirical evidence that's been put out now, where I haven't dove into the study, so it would be interesting. Maybe that could be a future podcast where we like dive into the methodologies of this. But supposedly, about 30% of Canada's reduction in carbon emissions can be attributable to either the large emitters tax or the personal carbon taxes, the more like consumer level ones. Now, I think it's not half and half. It's something like 20% is the large emission, like the large emitters one, and 10% is the other one. But it does seem like there is some effect that's happening because of these taxes so far. Yeah, I want to talk about some of the politics because I know there's been like a lot of moments in question period. There was one with Andrew Scheer literally grilling the poor quant from the PBO that was coming in, and he was basically just beating out of him like two different numbers. And really the guy was like, well, if you look at the fiscal impact on households versus the economic impact on households. And that's, I think, actually maybe a distinction that we didn't really talk about before, where there is like this fiscal impact that is actually how much you're paying in taxes, how much it's actually costing goods, subtracting how much you get back in the rebate. Whereas there are actually additional factors that do need to be taken into account, which is loss of industry, because there are jobs in the oil sector, right? So there is loss of incomes on aggregate, and there's loss of revenues from those companies that are profits. That, I mean, profits usually go to the richest people because they're the ones that hold the shares, but those profits are money that goes back into the economy. The way that the PBO kind of calculated this, I would like to say with like take a grain of salt, because they assume that people are not going to find other jobs, or there's going to be literally like they're only calculating the loss in jobs of those industries, assuming that there's going to be no possibility for them to transition to alternative employment because they couldn't model that. And so in that case, when you look at it, then it's only the bottom quintile of individuals, so the lowest 20% of people that actually come out at a net positive when they consider these other types of costs in terms of, like, as I said, so it's employment and returns like profits from these companies. But just to argue against why I'm bringing this up, it's like we needed to transition away from these industries. I don't know why these costs, I don't think these costs are unavoidable. And I think if we build new industries, like these people should be able to find new jobs and should be able to, like, we should be able to innovate our way around a lot of these economic costs, in my view.
Does this PBO report, though, take into account like the redistribution into new areas of demand from the rebate, or are they only, do they include the increase in,
No. They're basically taking like the net additional costs of like pass-through costs, right? Like, you know, it generally costs more to make a carrot because there's a carbon tax.
Yeah.
Even though it's like 2 cents a carrot or whatever. That's the one that sticks in my head. The direct that you're paying on the gasoline, the direct you're paying on the natural gas, subtracting the rebate. And then they're just calculating on aggregate, like the loss of employment from those sectors.
I see.
Based on, you know, at a given price point for the carbon, how much less profitable those companies will be. So they anticipate this much loss of employment, and they anticipate that much loss of profit from those companies. So then they subtract those all basically across the board, and they skew that a little bit towards the higher quintiles because they tend to be more likely to be employed in those companies or be shareholders in those companies. And then down the line, that's all they did.
Understood. Yeah. And I think it just at a minimum, again, like if this was a standard program, the government would spend the money how they would spend it. And that's how we should think about it, like spending as a whole, is it useful or not? But when it's just a rebate, most of that will be soaked up by just higher demand into prices of that have a lower relative price. Now, there will still be some deadweight loss because by definition, the economy is structured in a way that's the most profitable, right? All things being equal. And you're saying, well, I'm now going to have to force you to buy things that you otherwise wouldn't have. So it has to be less optimal, at least in the short term anyway. But it cannot be the case that, you know, you're creating these huge disruptions because prices change in the economy all the time for market reasons, not just because of taxes, right? Yeah. Oil prices go up and down all the time, whether or not it's taxes. It just causes industries to change, right? So people are less likely to move to Alberta, more likely to stay in Quebec or Ontario, as the case may be. And then you just end up with different distributions of sector, basically investment.
Yeah. And I think actually that's a really important point, I think, because you see a lot on like online forums, talking to people who really are against the carbon tax, that's something that they really cling to, is that idea of, even if they're like, you know, really well-versed, they really understand these PBO reports, like we're trying to discuss now, they do say like, the end of the day, we were using oil and gas because it was more efficient and our lives were better for it. There's usually, they have no belief in climate change at all. So they think that there's no cost in that way. But like, I think that is true, that you have to take an assumption that electric vehicles will never be as good as internal combustion engines, as one example, or like, you know, heat pumps could not possibly heat a home as well as natural gas. And that you have to think that is not because we're in this is another technical term, a local minimum, or right, where because natural gas, maybe for home heating, is just so widespread, the cost for each person to use natural gas is lower because it's being mass produced right now. But as soon as the heat pumps get to that level of adoption, then they might actually be a lower level. And there's some evidence for heat pumps, as an example, because the physics is actually more conducive to better efficiency within some margins, right? I think like when you start to get down to negative 30, negative 40 temperatures, no, I think actually it might have been lower than that. It might have been negative 20 Celsius, that then you need to start to supplement with a different set of heating sources. But even in that case, if you're generating electricity from solar or wind, and if that was as large of an industry, maybe that would be a different local minimum. So it's very, very uncertain when you start to make that kind of an argument that we're at some kind of global efficiency.
The point is that it's not easy to just simply dismiss changes in the economy as all being good or all being bad, right? Like the economy is complex. There's all sorts of ways we can substitute for technologies today. Technologies change over time. Overall, again, when you factor in, this is now I'm adding my view here. When you factor in the rebate, effectively, if wealthier households are net payers on average, you may actually have a slightly larger economy in the short term because there's less savings and more consumption. So lower households will take all of the rebate and spend it, whereas wealthier households will take the rebate and save it. But because wealthier households get less of the rebate because they're a smaller share of the population, overall, you may even see higher consumption. All of which is to say is that these effects, only looking at just simply the cost, are misleading when you don't factor in either the rebate or how the tax is used, like what goods and services are it's used to purchase. In this case, the government has no decision on what goods and services to purchase because the money is just given back to people in an equal block grant, in effect.
I think the other reason that it's really struggling politically is like we've just had this incredibly long preamble to bring people up to speed on the technical understanding that you need. It's incredibly complicated. And so it's very easy to just like throw away all the nuance and just say, I'm sticking to my guns and like the carbon tax is bad and cost of living is hard and this must be causing it. And people can then take like this PBO report and really spin it to say whatever you want, right? You can say, oh, it's a net cost for everyone, or it's a net benefit for everyone. It depends on what partisan side team you're on, which is very unfortunate.
If I may just play the other side here for a second,
Yeah, for sure.
which is that I think one of the key issues is that it's very much focused on domestic production. Consumers, well, there's two parts, right? There's the what we think of as the carbon tax, which is what we all pay when we fill up our tank of gas or heat our homes, and then the large emitter. So basically industries have various like systems. There's like a basically a tax plus a subsidy. We don't really have to get into it, but it's the same principle. That it encourages producers to be less carbon intensive, but still produce the same amount. But a key issue, though, is that a carbon tax in an international world where not everyone has a carbon tax can actually lead to, if you're not careful, something called carbon leakage, which means that global carbon emissions go up. So, easiest case, right? Oh, fertilizer becomes impossible to produce in a country with a carbon tax because fertilizer is massively energy intensive. And then, so we import our fertilizer from another country with no carbon tax, but they use even more carbon intensive energy to produce it. And so the world as a whole is worse off. And that local economy has less production. So it's a really bad loss. You lose GDP, and then you still get more carbon emissions. Now, the federal government in their system for the kind of the big polluters, they claim that they've tried to address it. I'm not an expert in it, by basically setting differential subsidies depending on how much international competition there is for the product to avoid this issue. But let's be clear that if that system isn't set up properly, you can get really bad consequences of actually more global emissions and less domestic production. The carbon tax is not without its issues in that front, just even from a technical perspective.
No, yeah, I agree, right? Like, I think that's one of the big failings of it is that it's not really being able to account imports. And I think that unfortunately that's kind of a political barrier and not necessarily a technical barrier because we have, well, it's not called NAFTA anymore, but we have the NAFTA free trade agreement with the United States. And so if we start to try and apply any carbon tax on goods coming from them, then we're going to be up to our eyeballs in international court proceedings. It's a huge problem, and it's something that needs to be fixed. I don't think that it's a big enough problem that it makes throwing out the carbon tax, like the carbon tax, a net negative on society, but it's something that needs to be fixed. I mean, the bigger issue too that I have just with the policy itself is I don't think that the rebate is enough carrot to too much stick. To just give people back the rebate for consumption doesn't acknowledge the fact that when you're buying a natural gas heater, the operating cost is actually a small fraction of the cost to switch over to an entirely new source, right? You need to pay the huge installation costs. And I think that that's a big issue that, yes, these people are getting back in the bottom 20% $500 a year, but that's not going to help you pay the $5,000 you need up front to overhaul your heating system in order to be able to save that carbon tax so you have lower operating costs. So that's what was the biggest argument and why they've politically shot themselves in the foot, the liberals, with that whole heating oil thing, was like, it costs an incredible amount of money to get rid of a heating oil system, put in even a natural gas system. And though, yes, that does save you on the back end for your operating costs, a lot of these people that were stuck with the heating oil are retirees, and so they don't have that upfront money. And they really just need some kind of government carrot to get you over that startup cost so that you can then be more profitable on the other side, basically, as a household. And I think that's the biggest issue that I have with the carbon tax, is that, you know, it's progressive in that the poor people are getting back more, but they're also the ones that struggle the most to actually make a transition to a new system because of that. That transition cost is almost insurmountable.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think to add on to that too, again, we're only speaking here in averages, but there's going to be huge variations in the kind of average beneficiary, what they look like as you change geographically, right? So in very rural communities, even the median person is just going to have like no options to really change their carbon consumption. And so like, do you take the train? Do you drive? Do you carpool? Like, that's just not going to be an option in like rural Canada. And again, I know that there's differential rebates if you're in rural areas or not too.
Yeah, but it's a pittance.
Yeah. And this is the part that no one wants to say out loud, but that's actually part of the design. The design of the carbon tax is ruthless in this way, in that it says, like, look, like, if you live in a local economy whose local economy disproportionately depends on carbon, part of the stick that drives down carbon emissions over time is basically forcing some people to relocate. There are now going to be some people that move to the big city that otherwise wouldn't have, because their rural life becomes too expensive. And that's actually part of the carbon tax design. Now, again, you can do it either. You don't just have to do, doesn't have to be tax, excuse me, does not have to be a stick. It can be a carrot. So you could subsidize people to move. Again, economists are heartless people. They don't care. Economists doesn't look at the economists care about outcomes. They can say, well, you can do a subsidy to move people. You can do a tax to move people. They don't care. Economists generally can show that taxes are more efficient in the sense that they cost less to achieve the same outcome, but they might cost more emotionally and politically cost the same outcome. And that's the problem, which is that people will be more emotionally responsive to someone in some sense almost being forced to move because they that don't want to, than some sort of nebulous idea about having to raise income tax by 1% to fund a subsidy program, and then income tax reduces the hours worked and shrinks the size of the economy by some amount that you can't quantify or can't see. It's real, but you don't really feel it, right? And so this is why the sort of like optics and like kind of visceral reaction to different policies can lead to these different outcomes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, right? Like, people put a large emphasis on their identity, and these people live in these rural communities and they have roots there and they have history, and you are actively discouraging them from living that lifestyle, and that makes it difficult. It's a big issue, climate change, and we need to fix it, but why does the carbon tax have to make these people change their way of life? Why can we not build in subsidies? Like, let's raise my taxes. I mean, I'm only in the like 75, 70 to 80 percentile or whatever. Raise my taxes and let's better electrify all these small communities. I feel like we need a lot more doing to help these people, because I think that keeping their rural way of life, I think, matters a lot to these people. And I feel like, yeah, it is fairly heartless what we're doing in this respect.
Going back, redesigning this policy. It's 2015. What would
Yeah.
you have done differently for the Liberals being elected? I know they didn't pass legislation until like 2018, technically, and didn't come into effect till
Yeah.
2019, but whatever. Going back in time, what do you do differently?
To me, I think you keep the carbon tax, but you've got to make the rural benefits got to be way larger. And you have to then, they were not concerned about deficits. So, okay, where are the subsidies for electrification? For we have a lot of provinces that are like BC Hydro, they run their entire electrical grid. Where is the federal money that's working with the provinces to expand out the electrical grid to all these rural communities so that they can get fast chargers and they can get electric vehicles as soon as possible so that they can get heat pumps? Now, I think a big issue is a lot of that tech, like heat pumps have really become a lot more viable since 2018. And so that's kind of difficult. I think there's like a lot of hindsight is 2020. And so a lot of these changes that I'm recommending are maybe like, I know that these techs are coming. So I'm wondering if that's biasing how I know what would have been a smarter move. Yeah, could have been better.
Are you saying that you would have kept the carbon tax as is, but basically had the government spend more money to complement the carbon tax? Or are you saying you would have had the carbon tax lower and have more other policies that would have gotten the same reduction in carbon, but then would have cost, you see what I'm saying? Like, are you saying you would have had the same
Oh
reduction in
no,
carbon through?
I would have said had the carbon tax the same, because like, and then also we need the subsidies. And I don't know if, from an inflation standpoint, to keep the deficit down, we would have needed to raise taxes on income taxes in general. And maybe that would have been complete political suicide, but I'm not making any political considerations in how I would have made this better.
I wonder, like, if it's just a demonstration that actually carbon taxes politically can't work. I don't know if I think that's the case, but I think that a reasonable argument could be made in the sense of, like, if you look at the significant carbon reductions that the US economy has managed to achieve, it hasn't done it with a carbon tax. I know some states have, like, one, like California, I think, maybe that's
Yeah,
like the only one,
California.
but like, I know almost no other state has it. And the main reason is just because of a bit of serendipity, right? Fracking made natural gas prices have collapsed in the US so that they basically reduced their coal plants. That's just not going to happen in Canada because outside of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and like Nova Scotia, every other province basically gets their electricity from hydro or nuclear. The US was just in a situation where there was these areas where
There's low-hanging
non,
fruit.
yeah, basically just energy production could be different. But I wonder if it points to just like generally like politically, maybe the quote unquote like costlier ways are the only way to do it. And like there's also the other thing too, I can't help but think about here is just housing. If you could just change housing so that housing is cheap, then people can live in like high density neighborhoods. It's less, I mean, how are you going to move from a rural community where like a house costs like $1 million? And it's not going to happen. That also is another thing that makes it so painful is moving to the city when the city's so expensive. It's just even that much worse. If you think of the population densities between Windsor to Quebec City is like 60, 70% of the Canadian population or something lives along that corridor, give or take, right? And so like maybe there's all these like transit investments or housing investments you could have made or regulation changes that would have had these sort of, again, like kind of indirect, they're not designed to reduce carbon emissions, but they just in incidentally do.
Yeah. But I think, like, with the Canadian political system, like, if you're just the Liberals, how do you get that done, right? Like, Ontario's got
Yeah,
Doug
you can't.
Ford. There's literally no political will there. Yeah, you had the Alberta NDP for a little while there, and they put in their own carbon tax and they put forward a lot of the wind power and stuff, but they're now gone, and all the wind power subsidies that they put in has just become wasted money because Daniel Smith has canned all the projects. If I think back to the precise political situation that the Liberals were in and the power that the federal government has, I'm not really sure what they could have done differently, because a lot of the like subsidies and infrastructure spending and things really depends on buy-in from the provinces, and they just never had that.
Yeah, no, yeah, you've convinced me. Your idea of like, look, you should get the carbon tax the same, but give people a way to feel like there are ways that they can change. The reason they chose the more carbon intensive consumption bundle before you impose the tax, how do you make them feel like this new carbon less consumption bundle is like good or like less painful? And if it's basically through basically forcing them to take the bus by giving up their car or moving cities in a like in a kind of disgruntled way, then politically it's going to basically it's going to work technically. It's going to reduce carbon emissions because
But
demand
you would
curves
have
slope
had the same
downwards.
political blowback, and then as soon as you're out, then it's gone.
It's gone.
Yeah. And so that's why, I wonder, maybe Joe Biden is the only one that's onto it, where you really start to build these huge industries that are clean and you really heavily subsidize them so that we can kind of, you basically hope that electric vehicles and heat pumps are actually going to be more efficient one day. And you basically just subsidize the crap out of that and make a ton of jobs. So that hopefully you can just get over that hump, and that then ideally technology will bring you home. Maybe that's the only way to do it.
But your argument, though, also had some resonance with me, which is just you're just saying, like, look, we just you can't only rely on the cruel relative price changes of the tax. You need to complement it with these subsidies, which feel empowering. That hasn't been tried. So
Yeah,
that
but at the
that's yeah.
time, in 2015, right? I just think that there was no knowledge of these
There
heat
was
pumps and
or
electric
electric
vehicles,
cars.
right? Like, I'm basically giving myself the knowledge of, like, oh, look at these cars BYD is making. Look at how efficient they are. Look at the amazing advances we've had in solar voltaics. Look at the amazing advances we've had in heat pumps. But in 2015, I don't think I knew that was coming.
And then to your other point, the things that would have worked, like better transit systems and housing, are completely out of your federal
Out of your hand as
purview.
the federal government, yeah.
Wow.
Unless you could have gotten provincial partners, but I just don't think, looking back, the only ones would have been BC and Alberta. And maybe you then just like shower money on BC and Alberta and just make all these marginal gains there. Quebec too, actually. You know, Quebec's always had pretty good support. The CAQ is pretty anti-climate change. So maybe you just shower money on there, but you know, at the end of the day, all of your seats are on Ontario and Atlantic Canada. And that's probably going to have some political blowback.
But it's sort of like a kind of maybe depressing or counterintuitive conclusion after all the time we've spent explaining. I guess like most of the first half was us and me taking the lead on just explaining technically why a carbon tax does work
Yeah, well,
and
so
that
I
it
mean,
is progressive. But
if we're cold-hearted bastards, it works amazing. But it's like, but as soon as we make some kind of assumption that like people who have these rural roots that want to be able to essentially try and keep the lifestyle that they wanted, then that's where the political, like the rubber meets the road. As soon as you make that assumption, then I don't think the carbon tax becomes your viable solution anymore.
But now the majority of Canadians have turned against the carbon tax in one way or the other, right? Like some large share, maybe slightly less than 50%, want it scrapped entirely. Then another share wants it paused, and the further share wants it reduced. And so, like the remaining people who are just good with it and want it to keep going up is probably like 5 to 10% of the population at this point. It can't be all of those people are people yearning for their lifestyle of
Well,
like.
yeah, I mean, I think in that point, though, I think that that's the political fight that they've lost then, right? I think that Pierre Poilievre has made this carbon tax a boogeyman that, and this was like my point earlier about how it's so technical, anybody can see whatever they want in it. And so, like, a lot of people were like, all inflation was the carbon tax, all 8% of it when we were at peak. Was it 8%? Maybe we only
Something
hit
like that.
six, but whatever it was entirely carbon tax. If we didn't have any carbon tax, we wouldn't have had any inflation. To me, I think that that's like a political loss. That's like, it doesn't really matter what the policy was. If there was anything that had the, yeah, if you did any kind of cost at all, then it seems like people were able to like apply that boogeyman-ness to it. And so maybe if you had tied the tax with other subsidies that people liked, then that would have cut it off at the pass. I don't know.
Like, what about more kind of tying it to the idea of like the money you're getting back? Because like to the extent, like hypothetically, suppose it was the case that 100% of 8% inflation was attributable to the carbon tax, because it doesn't really matter, because it just means that the rebate would be massive, right? You're talking about a
Yeah, but
rebate
these
in
are
the
also
hundreds
the
of billions of dollars.
people.
Yes.
These are the people that, like, they don't know that they're even getting a rebate. They, like, they don't
Right,
even
but
believe they're getting money.
yes, that's the point, which is like you could, to you make the argument like, look, the more the carbon tax collects, the more money you get back. And if you consume less gasoline than the average person, right, then you are winning. Like, what percent of the people understand that if you consume less than the average, it's technically not gasoline, it's a mix of these products plus the products that use them by a high degree, but it's roughly true, right? To the extent that, like, do people have that idea that if I'm a below average in my consumption level, I win? Like,
No,
I'm
they
not sure
don't. No,
people understand.
I don't think so. Yeah, I think you're right that people don't understand that. Like the topic is too complicated and they don't believe it. Now, you know what? You kind of raise a point. Like, what if it was like 8% of all expenditures was now the carbon tax? Maybe it would be large enough that people would like actually see it happening, right? Like the effect would be large enough. So I wonder, like,
The rebate,
could
you
it?
mean? What do you mean by effect?
Like, oh
Just to
no,
clarify.
like the carbon tax. So like you put forth the hypothetical, let's say all 8% of inflation was carbon tax. So let's say like the carbon tax got implemented, 8% of all expenditure in the economy just went up, like all prices just went up 8% because of the carbon tax. But then that rebate would be huge.
Yeah, it'd be like hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah. So I mean, it's almost like because we've had this inflation timed at the same time as a carbon tax that's actually quite tiny, that then people think like there's room for people to attribute all of inflation to the carbon tax and then be like, this rebate is absolutely a pittance. Obviously, it's not
I see.
enough. And so it's almost like because the carbon tax's timing with this massive bout of inflation has just nail in the coffin it.
Okay, so I think it's the two issues there. One is that there's just not an understanding that when you consume less than the average, you're a winner,
Yeah.
because the people that are above average get the same rebate but are spending more, and they're what's driving your rebate higher than what you're spending on it. And then the
Yep.
second is just how that could possibly link. So it can't, if it, again, if it's the case that all of this money is going to the carbon tax, it's still, the logic is still the same, which is, am I a winner or a loser only depends on how much money I'm getting back. And if the math doesn't add up, it either means that I'm just a massive consumer, which should be hopefully obvious to most people that that's not the case, right? Or that I've misunderstood what's driving inflation,
Well, they or
right?
they think that they're, well, yeah, they but they I think they think that it's a lie, right? They are more likely to side with the carbon tax is causing this inflation or whatever it seems like for a certain segment. I mean, because when you're talking though about 60, 70% of people want the carbon tax gone, I don't know what poll that's from. I haven't seen that, to be honest.
I did find one poll that 42% want it scrapped, 17% want it cut temporarily. So you're already at 60% of people want it
Yeah,
completely
some kind of
gone or gone
frozen.
for a short amount of time. And then the remaining 40% are not all people that want it. A huge share of those then don't want it to go up. So then,
Yeah.
like, there's very few people that want it to keep going up.
Yeah, so I mean, that seems like a lot of people. Maybe that's the proportion of people that don't have the energy or the time to spend to really dig into the numbers to understand that they're not, that most of the cost increases are not the carbon tax and that they're probably a winner in terms of their consumption.
But
Though
I
maybe
will say,
20% of that is the richest 20% of people because that's just the baseline because they're losers and they don't care.
but actually, to be fair though, Jared, like, I've thought about it. Like, I don't know if I'm a net winner or loser. I sus from a, just a purely fiscal perspective, I suspect I might our house might be a slight loss, but I'm not sure, right? Because we have a very small house, we have one car, we sometimes fly. I know there's a huge share of the population, like the bottom, maybe 20% of the population doesn't own a car. But so I just don't know. Even I don't know. Like, I don't think it's too much of a gain or a loss, but even I'm not exactly sure if I'm slightly positive or slightly negative.
Yeah.
And I'm very well informed about, like, economics and rough like understandings of consumption. I have a much better sense of like where my income is in the Canadian population. I don't really have a good sense of what my carbon consumption is relative to the average Canadian.
Yeah. Well, so there was like a long time ago, I did a CBC calculator.
Okay.
And so they've tried to put things forward, if you trust the CBC, because they basically used carbon pricing costs for households and progressivity of revenue recycling options in Canada, winter et al. 2023. I believe they had the different like marginal costs for the average household, and they broke it up into deciles. So they broke it into electricity, gasoline, natural gas heating sources is the one that I was looking at. That's energy use, right? Carbon cost source. Here we go. Sorry, it was where they estimated like indirect costs. So that's like the cost for businesses passing along your electricity, gasoline, natural gas, and heating oil, depending on what province you were in. Through that, maybe you would be able to use those kind of calculators and be able to calculate it, but they're just not like that widespread.
But isn't that a great example? Which is, and sorry, I want to clarify. It's not that I technically don't know if I'm like a bit above or below average. I know I'm not an outlier, right? So like I have enough common sense to understand that there are some households that own no cars and don't travel because plane tickets are too expensive. I know there are some houses, because I see them, that own three cars and they fly every other month. Okay. And so they're obviously going to be losers relative to me, that is. I don't know where I personally fall. Like I'm not in the 10th and I'm not in the 95th percentile, but maybe I'm somewhere, maybe I'm the 30th, the 60th. I'm not exactly sure. But to your point, you just said, you know, they're like maybe having a tool, like saying, like, okay, well, what's your natural gas bill? How much do you spend on gas every month? Blah, blah, blah. How many cars do you own? How many basically plane trips do you buy? And get like a pretty good estimate of where you are, but no one really knows. Like that could have been something that government could have helped almost like gamify, like, oh, am I above average or below average? Like, how do I get down so that I'm making more
80%
from
of
this rebate?
people are less than the median user of carbon.
But the funny thing is that 80% of people could be less than the average user of carbon. And see, that's
That's
the
true.
key
That
idea,
could be.
right? Which is the rebates based on the average. And averages can be skewed by outliers, which is why, again, the rebates are progressive, because the
Yeah.
top consumers are actually like they
Outliers, yeah.
can. There are some people that can literally fly every other day because they're jet setting business types, but the average person can't live that lifestyle.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a sense that I would say I'm in the 70. I would say I'm probably also in the 70% of carbon usage because of how often I'm flying. Yes, I only have the one car. And yes, I do take like the GO train into work the one day a week that I go into work. And my wife takes the GO train as often as possible. So it's only like a 15-minute drive. And it is a sedan. So it's like on the mild side. But I think the fact that we fly back, two of us, twice a year just basically blows away all other carbon emissions that we do. So to me, I think that that's where I'm at. If I wasn't taking two flights a year, I would have guessed I'm in the like 30%, in the 30% top. That would have been my guess.
But again, even we don't know. So we know we're somewhere, we're not in the outliers. We know that it can't be costing us that much more or less. Like we're maybe spending a few hundred dollars above or getting a few hundred dollars back. We're not exactly sure. But we don't even know exactly how to calculate it. And to the extent that the government hasn't provided tools for households to do this, that's kind of a failure on their part.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. Because I think I was trying to think of it like, is there an argument against where they're like laying claims of propaganda against them or something? But I mean, I think everything they say gets claims of propaganda laid against them. So they might as well have tried to put out calculators or something. So, or some kind of framework, even.
A somewhat dispiriting conclusion. Taxes work economically, technically, but not
And even
politically,
there
we'll
is
see.
empirical evidence that the carbon tax seems to be reducing people's consumption habits. But
Right.
I don't think it's going to last because I have no faith that the liberals are going to turn
That's
this
fair. Wait, actually, Jared, I have an overrated versus underrated for you. Very politically topical in the last 48 hours.
Okay.
Fourplexes.
Oh, underrated. Who doesn't want neighbor? Like, I think fourplexes would be great. Like you have neighbors that you're like much closer to. You know, I think suburban life and fully detached homes are so isolating. And a fourplex, you have neighbors that then you're much closer with. And if you just happen to move into one then where there's people of a similar age to you, you could try and select for that. And like you can build great friendships. I feel like that would be way better. It just life would be way better at just that mild increase in density would solve so much.
Perfect. All right, well, we've got our overrated versus underrated quota in. Thanks everyone for listening to the 18th episode of the Statistically Significant Podcast, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.